Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! To this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, our one and only home. Although you can also find the Horn at various other streaming platforms, as mobile, interweb, your devices, your outlets, your smartphones, places, tune in radio, and secure internet radio. Carry the Horn, dar.fm, streama.com. There's a lot of them. And you're welcome to listen any way that you see fit, whatever works best for you. Now, it is Titanic Tuesday. It is, in fact, the 29th day of October 2013. October quickly running away from us. I'd run away, too, considering what this October has seen. Oh, goodness me. At HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you can always find your way to the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room, where you are always welcome. Let's have a quick peep and see. Tim's there. Sparky's there. More will be along presently. Hey, guys. That's true, Tim. You are not welcome in the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room if you're a teabagger. Heck, we'd rather you didn't even listen to the program. They do, but, you know, can't do much about that. So, yes, the chat room link is there. The Listen Live link is there. And also, something else, the means by which we keep this program going, the PayPal button is there, as is the traditional mail address. For those who would rather not go running to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, let me repeat that traditional mail address right now. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower, Eisenhower, like the president. In fact, that's what it's named for. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, stands for Personal Mailbox, 318 Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. Checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not. Make it payable to Head On Communications. That way, Boss Man Wayne, who, when gloriously met with something besides an echo in the mailbox, then forwards them on to the account so we can do things like pay all the various and sundry bills, which we have in the offing waiting to be paid. And we find ourselves this evening, this Titanic Tuesday evening of the 29th day of October 2013, we find ourselves in a hole. The hole is $280 deep at this point in time. We try to raise $150 for every program. Sometimes we hit, sometimes we miss. Sometimes it rains. But yesterday was a miss. Thanks to the two folks who did kick in to help keep things going, we raised $20 last evening, and hopefully, well, that puts us in the position of needing to raise $280 this evening, $150 for this evening, and $130 to catch up with yesterday evening. Because bills come due at the beginning of the month, some bills come due at the middle of the month, others come due at the end of the month. The end of the month bills are due. So that's where we find ourselves. So anybody wanting to help out, paypal.com is the place that I may be going on is... Actually, I know why that's happening. I have to upload Dr. Bill's program every evening as soon as it ends. So that's what may be causing you some buffering issues. They will resolve momentarily. take too terribly long at all.
Check.
Yeah, about 9 minutes left in the upload because hopefully it is not going. Hopefully it won't be too god awfully terrible. Yeah. So Titanic Tuesday, right? Where to go? Where to go? Where to go? Remember, you may remember yesterday I mentioned that god awful profiteering maze in the state of. It's not a state. By God, it's a commonwealth. The Old Dominion, Virginia, where they're going to mock people who died in mining disasters and charge $32 a head to do it this Halloween season. No, I don't have an update saying that they have seen the light of reason and common sense and have decided not to do it. No, I wish I did. No, I've got a little reality. Now, that's imaginary miners abandoned in an imaginary mine 70 miles in the roll, what the Washington Post described as the rolling hills of Virginia south 70 miles south of Washington D.C. That's all imaginary. This here, what I've got right now, is reality. One of the largest coal producers in the United States is Consol Energy, CONSOL. CNX on the New York Stock Exchange, in case you're considering not going out and buying stock. Divestiture, it's a big thing these days. Highly recommend it. Make you feel good. But Consol has seen the writing on the wall. Many, many take a Lou Farson, I think, was the writing on the wall, if I recall. And they're getting out of the coal business, at least in Appalachia. They've sold off a handful of their longwall coal mines in West Virginia to a subsidiary of, drumroll please, no, it's not a drumroll really, how about a couple of mournful blats on a, yeah. Consol has sold out its operations in West Virginia to a subsidiary of Murray Energy Corporation. At this point in time, you may think, Murray Energy. Why do I remember Murray Energy? Oh, Bob Murray! Yeah, that walking turd on two legs whose avaricious practices and remorseless desire to make money wound up in, 13 people dead in the Crandall Canyon mine disaster in Utah? Yeah, that Bob Murray. Which Bob Murray? Oh, the Bob Murray whose mine was used as a stage prop. Miners were used as a stage prop for Bishop Willard Rockfeld bid to get marrying off the government. Those 47% moochers. Ew. Working miners were told that they had no choice if they wished to continue receiving a paycheck but to go to and allow themselves to be used, basically used, by the Romney campaign in Ohio. Yeah, that Bob Murray. Bob Murray, who said that the election of Barack Obama would cause him to have to perform Christian layoffs and throw people out of work because of the Kenyan Muslim socialist anti-imperialist, right, that Bob Murray. Yeah, he's going to own mines in West Virginia now. So whereas what's going on in the rolling hills of Virginia, south of 70 miles south of Washington, D.C., is fantasy and in incredibly poor taste and shows a degree of sympathy for people who are still suffering on a par with the degree of sympathy shown by vultures and turkey buzzards for that upon which they are about to alight. Well, this is even worse. This is more dangerous. This foreshadows something wicked this way comes. Because this isn't imagination. Ask the widows and the orphans of the Crandall Canyon disaster how real it is. And yet there is nothing to stand in the way, really, of Murray Energy purchasing up Consol Energy's Northern West Virginia operations. Not a thing. It's just business. Tell Michael I always liked him. It was only business. It's just business. I mean, if the price is right, if there's offer and acceptance and consideration, just like they teach you in first-year contracts in law school, you got a deal. It doesn't matter if Consol, in an effort to get out of Appalachia with its money and, you know, laugh all the way to the bank, it doesn't matter if they're selling it to if they're selling their operations to a company who can be counted on to court agony, misery, and in fact grim death. Doesn't matter, because those kind of ethics don't go into any consideration of profits, because it's all about the profits, right? Always, always about the profits. And if some human flesh and bone and gristle gets in the way and has to be stuck in a hole somewhere, and people stand around the hole in the ground and cry for a little while, well, that's just the price we pay for freedom in America, right? Yeah. Interesting things developing all over the place this Titanic Tuesday, so named for the Titanic intellects of the right wing. Yeah. It turns out that there's some wrangling going on over the Keystone X. XL pipeline. You know, that thing that the right wing keeps telling us to the land of frizzy sweet check 75 cent gasoline. Which, of course, isn't, because that's all a big fantastic lie. The Keystone Pipeline, we're waiting for a decision. A decision that I continue to worry about. But now, with a final review underway inside the United States State Department, they've hit on another strategy. If the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline doesn't get built, because they're already building the southern leg, and the stories are out there and easy to find about farmers in Texas who have had their property rights completely overrun, even though in Texas you can use deadly force to defend property. Well, now they're just trying to figure out, because they are hell-bent to get that tar sands filth from Alberta to the Gulf Coast of the United States, because they know they can't take it through their own country to the Pacific Coast and, say, somewhere like Vancouver, British Columbia, because the Canadians won't stand for it. So naturally, in the sort of life serial world that we live in, hey, let's get the United States to take our filth. They'll take it. They'll take anything. Mikey. Well, now with the internal review in its final stages at the State Department, a question has been put forward. What if we don't build the pipeline? What if we just deliver the oil down to Oklahoma Stan by rail? Hey, there's a great idea. Over at the brilliant desmogblog.com, 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 clearing the PR pollution that clouds climate science, they say, and they do a wonderful job. Carol Linnett writes, U.S. officials are evaluating the impact of that Keystone XL will have on expansion of the tar sands and whether or not the pipeline will worsen climate change. According to a new report by Reuters, the evaluation has created a balancing test, zeroing in on the question of whether shipment by rail is a viable alternative to the controversial project. The test's crux: if there is enough evidence that the oil sands region will quickly grow with or without the 1,200-mile line, that would undercut an argument from environmentalists. Getting to where I find that word to be absolutely obnoxious. Because it makes it sound like that people who oppose things like the Keystone XL toxic pipeline are just sitting around staring at their navels and thinking about birds and bugs and beetles and butterflies and nothing about the continued ability of humans to live on this planet, of which the Keystone XL pipeline will have a significant, or on which the Keystone XL pipeline will have a significant deleterious impact. But they say if there's enough evidence, the oil sands region, tar sands, sludge sands, filth sands, death sands, will quickly grow with or without the 1,200-mile line, that would undercut an argument from environmentalists that the pipeline would turbocharge expansion. And so it is that the Obama administration, particularly his State Department, as headed by John Kerry, has sought the opinion of rail executives to give their impression of the logistics required and the market dynamics and what hurdles they would face in running the tar sands, the death sands oil down to Oklahomistan in tanker cars. We're talking about a railroad train trip carrying 830,000 barrels of Canadian death tar to Cushing, Oklahoma, which describes itself as the pipeline crossroads of the world. You could not pay me to live within 1,000 miles of Cushing, Oklahoma. I think I'm just outside that. So they're trying to actually do an end run on the notion that the death sands sludge will be made worse by the death sands pipeline. And in the Reuters report, as detailed at DSmogBlog, notes, the rail industry says we can never possibly move that much oil. You're gonna have to have the pipeline. Gary Kubera is the owner of CANEUXS. For God's sakes, who named that company? How do you pronounce that? Canuxus? They're expected to move 100,000 barrels per day by the end of 2014. He said, we can move large volumes, but it will always be a niche service. Stu Hanlon at Gibson Energy, Inc. said, we remain very, very confident that rail is here to stay, not as a replacement for pipelines, but as a supplement to pipelines. Canada itself, Western Canada, has recently had 5 new loading terminals. And it's estimated the national transport capacity for death sand sludge is at 450,000 barrels per day by next year. Guess what? This is a bit of rat-murray. Because it is obvious that derailments happen, and so the phony baloney trade-off is to say, well, look, I mean, the pipeline's safer than... We could always deliver it by rail. You can have rail cars, you know, they derail, and things blow up, and people die, and, you know, it happens quite a lot, really. I mean, here's... Oh, let's see, derailment in Calgary. A petroleum train slumped into a river. Derailment in Saskatchewan, derailment in Ontario, derailment in Minnesota, derailment in Edmonton, Quebec. But We could just make this ever so much easier if we could just build the damn pipeline. And then instead of having a whole bunch of derailments, we could just have one giant monumental disaster. Isn't that cool? Because nowhere in any governmental structure does anyone have the ability to simply say no. To simply say no to these profit-seeking prophets of planetary death. What do you mean we have to stop doing what we're doing in the death sands? I mean, we got all that stuff up there. Everybody's got a job. Granted, they're all going to be dead of cancer in 15 or 20 years, but, well, you know, what the... I mean, you know, everybody, who wants to live forever, right? You could die in service to the petroleum industry and help us bake the whole effing planet. I mean, that's doing something with your life, right? Of course I said Quebec correctly. It's not Quebec. You guys sell me short. So watch the story. And just wait to see what kind of double cross hooey is in the works. For you, for me, for everybody who lives in the path of that sludge tunnel of death, and for the planet itself. Just watch. Because the money rules. We can talk about family values and little unborn fetuses until the cows come home, or, you know, die in a puddle of tar sand sludge, perhaps. But it makes no difference. The money rules. And I'd like to think otherwise. I yearn to be proven wrong. I'd love to see Barack Obama step out into the Rose Garden and say, "It's done. Ain't gonna be no tar sands pipeline. For freaking get it. I'm not going to be personally responsible for torching the planet." Anybody want to put $5 on that? You'd be betting $5 that Barack Obama does that. Yeah, I didn't think so. Even $5. Yeah, it's $5. I mean, around here, $5 is four 24-ounce cans of Labatt's Blue Light, fine Canadian beer. It's three, maybe four cans of Jack Mackerel. Oh, dear, did I say Jack Mackerel? Uh-oh. Yeah, I got that too. I haven't ruined anybody's dinner in a while. So why not? There's a I have to find the stupid browser. Earlier today, I ran across a story about what goes into fish feed. This has a lot of run and hide about it. I'm working on entirely too many different devices. But suffice to say, you know how you feel a little bit better about a piece of fish when you see wild caught? Well, that's, maybe that's marginally better. But no guarantee. Damn, I think I inadvertently killed the tab. Anyway. It turns out that the fish feed for, like, farm-raised salmon contains the ground-up remains of sick cattle, as well as the ground-up turkey and chicken feces. Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? Why is there ground-up chicken and turkey feces and potentially, well, sick cow in salmon feed? Well, the salmon... I mean, we checked in with the boys in accounts receivable over there at Amalgamated Salmon Feed, and well, they told us right off the bat that they haven't had a single complaint from a single salmon. They eat it right up. They love them some ground up turkey and chicken poo, apparently, the salmon. And here's the fun part. It's all perfectly legal. And even if it was illegal, guess what? The corporate profiteers would do it anyway. And by the way, I'm not talking about salmon farms in China. If that's what we're feeding the salmon in the farmed salmon here in the United States, imagine what they get there. Hey, Sammy Salmon, good, you're in luck today. We got Falun Gong surprise. With a little melamine for flavor. It's a cussed aggravation. I mean, I eat a hillbilly diet. I try not to do it all the time, but I'm genetically predisposed to eat bacon. So consequently, I try to eat bacon from, when I can afford it, from Benton's Bacon down in Tennessee, because at least I know that they're running the whole process. And it hasn't been produced on some assembly line where the pig carcasses are flying by to the tune of 32,000 a day like they do at the Smithfield, now Chinese-owned, Smithfield meat plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina. Right? Yeah. So, just remember, that farm-raised salmon, before he went to his long home, poo. It's what's for dinner. And all the vegetarians in the Horn family commune are saying, I'm so glad I'm a vegetarian. Oh, Bob. Why aren't you? Well, they're working on making me one. But I've just got this sneaking suspicion that it's a matter of trading that for, you know, something with the with a python ear gene spliced into my green pepper or something. Or hey, here's a fun one. How about an onion with a gene from a salmon stomach? Poo for you too! Woohoo! God. So, in the ongoing attempt to poison everybody on the planet, we got that. We got the tar sands. We got Bob Murray come to West Virginia. He's an Ohioan originally, so you guys will have to take credit for that. Don Blankenship, he's ours. And I long for the day that I see him marching into a federal prison somewhere. But you Buckeyes got to answer for Murray. So we got that. And then, just as a sort of a whipped cream on poop kind of story, I got this shortly before airtime from our buddy Rochelle. Rochelle, the militant librarian. Librarians are awesome. They seem so quiet and staid and reserved. But as the guardians of information and freedom of access to information, they can be absolutely terrifying to the plutocrats and the thugs. Hi, Bob. Attached is a screenshot, which I will share with you momentarily, of a Facebook post made by Calvert County, Maryland Commissioner Susan Shaw. She posted it last night, and it was taken down this morning. Funny how that happens. But alas, a certain outside agitator had already found it and captured it for posterity. I may have discussed some of the background on this with you. Dominion Energy is looking to turn their existing natural gas import terminal on the Chesapeake Bay, the fragile, still somewhat considerably toxic Chesapeake Bay, into an export terminal. If they succeed, it will be one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in the state. It will also be dangerous because liquefied natural gas is nasty stuff. And it is. It tends to go boom real good. It's practically got a liquid bud natural gas terminal practically has a flashing neon light that says terrorist here with a big target. Rochelle continues, and it would be the first of what the gas industry hopes will be a slew of export terminals. Export terminals? I thought we were interested in American energy security. That's what they used to tell us about why we needed to blow up mountains We're protecting American energy security. It would be the first of what the gas industry hopes will be a slew of export terminals, opening the floodgates for gas exports and significantly increasing pressure to drill. That means fracking. There is very little natural gas left that is recoverable through conventional gas drilling. It would also, of course, give the lie to all that energy independence horse hockey fracking advocates are always peddling. Well, that's what snake oil salesmen do. They peddle things. But the Calvert County Board of Commissioners have shown an intense eagerness to roll over for Dominion. I just get this mental image of Susan Shaw rolling over to get her tummy scratched by some corporate lobbyist for Dominion Energy. Oh, there, what's the They've already given the company use of county land for construction purposes, and They've also gone on the record numerous times praising the idea to the high heavens. Tonight, there will be a joint hearing of the board and the County Planning Commission, going on probably right now or soon, on whether to exempt the terminal from local zoning ordinances. Now, this is important. There will be a hearing of the board and the County Planning Commission on whether to exempt the terminal from local zoning ordinances. That sounds like a discretionary act, doesn't it? Whether to, local zoning ordinance, right? We like to call that local control. It's kind of a cool thing. I mean, in the United States of America, where democracy is at best aspirational, something like local control almost smells like the beginnings of democracy, doesn't it? Yes, Rochelle says, in essence, to surrender any authority the county might have to control how construction and subsequent activity proceed if the project goes forward. It's a complete elimination of the ability of the communities they ostensibly represent to take a part in the determination of their futures. Apparently, the board didn't think there would be a lot of trouble with this. Well, it's amazing how much money will blind people to the possibility. I don't see a problem. All I see is money. But with the combined efforts of several groups, regional, local, and national, they have been deluged with more phone calls and emails in the past week than they probably get in a month. They changed the venue at the last minute and with utterly insufficient notice to interested parties to accommodate the increased number of commenters and observers that this will probably attract. Enter Commissioner Susan Shaw's testy, highly inappropriate, and incidentally completely incorrect Facebook post. A local activist says she's just one step removed from a Tea Partier and is completely convinced that all the opposition is being manufactured by Big Greens, who, I might remind us all, are about as useless as teats on a boar hog. At any rate, Rochelle says, I caught her tantrum, and our allies have spent the day blowing it completely into proportion. Folks were upset before. They're fighting mad now. Going to leave soon to attend what I am sure will be an epic hearing. Expect a lot of pissed off folks on all sides. I will live tweet it at MD Frackdown. See you on the flip side. P.S. This is such a beautiful textbook case of how the internets can bite. It seems that Commissioner Susan Shaw, in addition to caring little about public input, also doesn't quite understand how this kind of thing can happen. It never disappears. It just goes into cash. So over at the Facebook page of Calvert County, Maryland, Susan E. Shaw posts the following.
The zoning hearing tomorrow night with regard to the Dominion Cove Point liquefaction project is merely to make the Calvert County zoning ordinance adhere to federal regulations.
Job-killing regulations.
Large energy-producing facilities are inspected by the federal government.
Job killers.
This is not a referendum on whether the project will be built or not. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, job killers.
I'm adding all the job killers, by the way.
Will determine if the plant is built, not Calvert County. Any office structures will be inspected by Calvert County. It is a waste of time to come to the zoning hearing if you have concerns about the Dominion Cove Point project. FERC hearings will be held later. Of course, if you want to waste your time, feel free.
Jesus, Susie, talk down much?
It's a waste of time. Don't show up. We know what's good for you. And a liquid natural gas project that can blow half of this county to kingdom come is very definitely good for you. Goodness.
God almighty.
This doesn't have anything to do with you little people, so why don't you just stay home? Isn't Honey Boo Boo on or something?
Susan Shaw apparently doesn't think much of democracy or even things that remotely smack of it. You can't make this stuff up. At MD Frackdown on Twitter. Let me fire up my feed and see if we've got anything out there. Timeline. Ah, it hasn't started yet. I was right. We are 18 minutes away. So everybody who plays out in the Twitterverse, go have a look at MD Frackdown, MD FrackDown, and you can. It'll be just like being in the room with
Susan Shaw, who doesn't want you to waste your time.
Kevin with an email, he says, funny you're talking about the tar sands train idea. Just got this email about tar sands trains exploding from Credo today. What a great idea. The tar sands train can come through your town and explode, too. Just think how famous your town can be.
Well, hell, you might even get a visit from Anderson Cooper.
And it'll be good for all sorts of business, especially the funerals. And the Credo action alert points to Lac-Mégantic, a town in Quebec. The crude oil train derailed and then exploded, blew away half the downtown, and killed 47 human beings. What's the cost of doing business? Right. Yeah. We're getting the business all right. Hey, thanks, Sal. Sal jumped out there this evening to get us started. And we are now only 27 folks at $10 a piece. 27 folks at $10 a piece, or 10 people at $27 a piece away from making tonight's fundraising goal. I think we can do it. Can we? PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. And so, too, is the traditional mail address. I've already repeated it once. I'm not going to do it twice. Nah. Thank you, Sal. In all seriousness, Sal's there night in and night out. And it is all, and his efforts are much appreciated. Thank you. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. Oh, you, Ron and Raleigh, you shameless old DJ, you. Ron has our bumper all queued up and ready to go. And a dandy it is, too. I would never have thought of that in a million billion years, Ron. That's a good catch. And breaking news. this happened today in the Congress of the United States, talking to a committee in the House of Representatives. South Carolina's in the house! The Director of National Intelligence is James Clapper. Clap on, clap off, he's a liar! He says that all U.S. spying, you know, the electronic variety, the National Security Agency variety, out there desperately trying to find out the secret ingredients of Aunt Minnie's famous brownies without a warrant, it's lawful. Lawful. One of those moments where there's a sort of a, you go, wait a minute, lawful? Why wouldn't you just say it's legal? Apparently because somewhere in the bowels of the national security apparatus, there's some sort of significant difference between lawful and legal. Sort of like the difference between naked and naked. Any good Southerner knows the difference between naked and naked. Naked is the status of having no clothing. Naked is having no clothing and being up to something. I suspect that's something similar to the difference between legal and lawful. NBC News reporting, Tracy Connor, staff writer, the nation's top intelligence official told Congress on Tuesday that the U.S. has been snooping on friendly foreign leaders for years and getting spied on by allies in return.
They did it first!
As controversy swirled over reports that the National Security Agency monitored the calls of German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other world leaders, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper gave the impression that he didn't know what all the fuss was about. Gave the impression that he didn't know from Shinola. Oh, really? That's Shinola? Smells funny. During a grilling by the House Intelligence Committee, I don't dare, do I? Do we dare look up the members of the House Intelligence Committee who did the grilling? I brought the charcoal starter. Yes, we dare. I have a feeling we may hurt ourselves. Intelligence.house.gov. Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, 8th District of Michigan. Let's see, Mac Thornberry of Texas-Stan, Jeff Miller, Mike Conaway of Texas-Stan, oh, there's Peter King, Frank Lobiondo, yeah, he's a big winner, Devin Nunes of California, Lynn Westmoreland, genius from Georgia, there she is, I knew we'd find her, yeah, one of the grillers today was none other than 1L Michelle Bachman, woohoo, catch her with a net. Mike Pompeo, lunatic from Kansas. Thomas J., no relation to Andy Rooney of Florida. But, yeah, Lynn Westmoreland and Michelle 1L Bachman. There's your grillers. James Clapper, who previously lied outright to Congress, said that spying on foreign leaders is what he called a hardy perennial. It's like an apple tree or something. That's a hardy perennial as long as I've been in the intelligence business.
Well, can you tell us whether they're spying on us? Does anybody know, for instance, have they spied on the Kenyan Muslim socialists' cell phone calls?
Absolutely.
And then he hauled up, my God, this is pathetic. He hauled out a chestnut from the movie Casablanca. I'm shocked to find that there is gambling going on here. You're winning, sir? Yeah, but see, that's the problem. Analogies like this should be handled delicately. Because I'm shocked to find out there is gambling going on here line is a line that is used to denote the hypocrisy of Captain Reynaud, the prefect of police in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find out there's gambling going on here. You're winning, sir. Oh, thank you. It marks him as a hypocrite, just like this marked James Clapper as a hypocrite, if, in fact, we had an intelligence committee that had any... I don't mean to put too fine a point on it. Intelligence on it! Why wouldn't we... Oh, never mind. So essentially, it was just a lie fest. I thought the real laugher was in this paragraph. Clapper said he would support declassifying secret intelligence court orders to boost transparency, and pointed to plans to hire a director of civil liberties and privacy. Gee, I wonder who's going to hire that. Should I send in a resume? I think Rick Smith would be a lovely director of civil liberties and privacy. So would Malloy. Yeah, I'm guessing we couldn't get the interview.
We believe that we have been lawful and that the rigorous oversight we've operated under has been effective.
Rigorous?
We do not spy on anyone except?
I think maybe the sentence needed to be phrased differently then, Alex. But we do not spy on anyone except for valid foreign intelligence purposes, and we do not violate the law.
So there's a valid foreign intelligence purpose in finding out whether or not Angela Merkel called home to make sure that the trash got sorted into the proper bins, because, you know, they have that in Germany.
Hey, Fred, did you make sure that the paper was sorted from the plastic from the glass?
Yes, sir.
All right. Report to the president, son. You've done your job.
And then, of course, the ubiquitous mistakes were made excuse. And then what I like to call the General Ripper excuse.
As Americans, we face an unending array of threats to our way of life. We need to sustain our ability to detect these threats, which include fluoride. Fluoride, Mandrake, in little children's ice cream.
And Clapper and General Keith Alexander both took a little time out for to slap Eddie Snowden around. You remember Eddie? Yeah, he's the guy who worked for the third party defense contractor and owed no allegiance to the United States whatsoever, and the third-party defense contractor let him have access to ungodly amounts of sensitive national security data, which he, in classic libertarian fashion, then decided was his to do with as he pleased. That side of the story really never gets mentioned, but there's actually benefit to having the information out there. Unfortunately, no one really reports on the profiteering private sector side of the story. Representative Charles Ruppersberger, a Maryland Democrat, said he'd like to see more oversight and transparency of NSA. But he also said, I shudder to think what connections would be missed if the program were eliminated.
Yeah.
I mean, we wouldn't know whether Angela Merkel prefers two-ply or one-ply. And if she's a two-ply gal, I mean, my God, doesn't that make her a hypocrite? What with her green government and everything and all that sustainability talk over there? Yeah, what? Yeah, all right. I'm shocked to find out there's gambling going on. Meanwhile, the spearhead of the move to alter the national security spying program is being led, and this inspires no confidence in me whatsoever, by representing James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. I keep trying to avoid putting the Stan on the end of Wisconsin because I yet have hope for what's going on up there. A lot of pushback. A lot of admirable pushback. Wisconsin refuses to go quietly into that dark night of teabaggerism. Nonetheless, they still have representing Jim Sensenbrenner, who said, somewhere along the way, the balance between security and privacy was lost. He just doesn't know where along the way it was lost. Jim Sensenbrenner was apparently either drunk or in a coma for the entire 8 years of the George W. Bush imperial presidency. Because that was where the balance between security and privacy, it wasn't lost. It was thrown bumping and rolling out of the back of the car, having been cudgeled to death in a burlap bag on some country roadside in northern Virginia. The balance was.
It's now time for the Judiciary Committees to again come together in a bipartisan fashion to ensure the law is properly interpreted, past abuses are not repeated, and American liberties are protected. Liberties! Liberties! Sit! Liberties! Sit! Washington must regain Americans' trust in their government. Not till you're gone, Jim! And all your teabagging buddies.
Incidentally, this past July, a similar effort to what Representative Sensenbrenner is bloviating about failed in his very own Republican-controlled House of Representatives. So just right, and the committee hearing is probably being, or the commission hearing is probably being gaveled to order in Calvert County, even as we speak. So we'll be keeping an eye out for that. We'll take a break right now. It being Titanic Tuesday and all, we have the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And we have thanks going out to Tony. Thanks very kindly, Tony. From you may recall Tony's note from San Antonio saying not all of us are like that Alex Jones goober who rallied the 300 weirdos on the plaza in front of the Alamo Saturday before last. Where we started the evening needing to raise $280. We now need to raise $245. Thanks to Tony and thanks to Sal. Thank you both very, very much. It is, in fact, what keeps all of this going. So, a little break with Bumper, kindly provided by Ron and Raleigh. This is Conversation Radio. Light up the phones if you want to. 304-658-3333 is the number. If you'd like to get in via Skype, the handle is Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. Bob Kincaid Horn. At Bob Kincaid on Twitter. And, oddly enough, Bob Kincaid on Facebook. Anyway is fine by me. Stand not upon the order of your calling, but call at once. Operators are not standing by. This is Conversation Radio. Here endeth the filibobster. I'm Bob Kincaid.
There's no time for us. There's no place for us. What is this thing that builds our dreams? Who wants to live forever?
Tuesday, October 29, 2013.
It was, here's your life, your whole life, your memories, everything. And it was gone.
1 year later, the lessons of Superstorm Sandy.
At some point, they're going to have to say, look, we just can't be here. It's too risky.
Scientists question rebuilding in coastal areas.
We're already committed to 4 feet more of sea level rise.
And warn of future climate impacts. Plus, it's official, the Poles are having a heat wave. No, not the Polish.
All of those Polish jokes and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It is 1 year since Hurricane Sandy ravaged the East Coast. The mainstream media continues to use the storm to push a global warming agenda.
And Fox News keeps ignoring the story to keep pretending none of this is happening. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, yes, Fox News continues to complain that the mainstream media talks about global warming and Hurricane Sandy in the same breath. Here's an example.
Every single time in the stories where they're talking about Sandy and either global warming or climate change, they're linking the two.
Imagine that.
I know.
They're linking the two.
It's crazy that science would actually be able to do something like actually link extreme weather events to climate change. But hey, that's Fox News. Tuesday marked the 1 year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy slamming into New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut on October 29th, 2012, one of the most expensive storms in U.S. history. Sandy killed at least 117 people and left millions without power. The storm and its 14-foot storm surge caused an estimated $65 billion in damage just days before the 2012 presidential election. And remember, the impacts of climate change weren't even mentioned in the presidential campaign.
I do. And it was shameful.
1 year later, the East Coast is still rebuilding. The hundreds of thousands of homes and buildings that were destroyed and the infrastructure that was heavily damaged. Recovery in the hardest hit areas has been very slow. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie blames the unprecedented resistance of Republicans in Congress to passing disaster assistance legislation.
These are problems when people still aren't back in their homes. But we warned of this way back when. You know, it took 92 days for the Congress to get the aid to the Sandy victims. That's compared to 10 days for Katrina and 17 days for Gustav.
Yes, and you know what else Governor Chris Christie was warned about while he's out taking curtain calls for his response to Sandy? He was warned about global climate change, and he pulled out of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative anyway, the landmark agreement of northeastern states, just after meeting with David Koch up in New York City secretly, as BradBlog.com reported exclusively in 2011.
That's true, and the right wing applauded him for that.
They did indeed, and we have the audio to prove it at BradBlog.com, the secret Koch brothers Chris Christie audio tapes.
Superstorm Sandy exposed the vulnerability of the East Coast and sparked a serious review of disaster and emergency planning for the increasing long-term impacts of climate change, especially related to storm damage. NASA's Dr. Radley Horton warns global warming boosted the flood damage from Superstorm Sandy.
Sea levels were higher when Sandy hit than they were, say, 100 years ago. As a result of that, the damage, the water piling up, was higher than it would have been before we had that sea level rise. And sea levels are rising primarily because of increasing greenhouse gases. Even if storms stay the same, higher sea level rise alone is going to be more frequent coastal flooding and more destructive coastal flooding when it happens.
That means difficult decisions ahead for all coastal communities in the United States, says sea level expert Ben Strauss of Climate Central.
We're already committed to 4 feet more of sea level rise. Committed, locked in the future. Okay, and that's enough to put more than 300 American towns and cities, many of them in New Jersey, mostly below high tide.
Which, the experts warn, at some point will have to impact land use decisions at the coasts, especially for insurers, says sea level expert John Miller.
At some point, they're going to have to say, look, we just can't be here. It's too risky. If government's not going to do it in a gradual manner, I think the insurance companies are going to start regulating.
Meanwhile, it's official. September 2013 was the fourth warmest September on record for the planet. The six warmest Septembers on record have all occurred in the last 10 years. It was also the warmest winter on record down south in Antarctica since record-keeping began nearly 60 years ago. Antarctica also just had its warmest September on record. Normally it's about 60 below, but it hit a downright balmy record high of minus 17 degrees on September 13th. And a new study now concludes the Arctic is the warmest it's been in 44,000 years.
All of that is impossible because Fox News keeps telling me that the globe is actually cooling. Oh, who to believe? For much more on that and the stories we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Remember, you can download us anytime via iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Find us and like us on the Facebook and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would have gone with the Bruce Springsteen Sandy instead of the. So I got to give Ferg credit. He does an excellent John Travolta exclaiming Sandy. God, where did that come from? Probably because it's Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, 13 minutes past 7 p.m. this 29th day of October 2013, and we're trying to get out of the fundraising hole. We are at $245 and hopefully counting downward for anyone who would care to help in that effort. The phone number, 304-658-3333, on Skype at Bob Kincaid Horn. Let's go forthwith to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, are you sure about that?
Well, you know, I guess I'm committed now, Bill. How about you?
Well, people, as they say, a lot of folks will say I should have been committed, but that's another story.
Yeah, purple crayon, soft walls.
Yeah, exactly. And, you play a lot of board games, which bore me to no end, but...
Yahtzee!
You too, huh?
Well, they took the... No, because you can throw the dice.
Oh. Yahtzee, I thought that was from food from some Asian restaurant, you know?
Yeah, right.
Or a body of water somewhere that I hadn't heard of.
He'll be here all week. Try the V.
Yes. This situation with this current administration and the stuff that they've been despising they've done. Of course, those of us who are old and have read a lot, we knew the Japanese Naval Code many years before the war.
Sure. And then there's the Coventry quandary, where the British government had cracked the German code and knew that Coventry was going to be bombed, but of course there was a greater value in being able to go on intercepting German communications, so they let Coventry be bombed.
Yeah, and they also kind of halfway knew that the Germans had something up their sleeves in December of 1944. And the bulge was seen by all, like me in a new tight pair of pants. But yeah, these things have been going on forever. But why would you listen to? Is there any kind of real reason on this green, well, once green earth, that they should be spying on Germany, for instance?
You want a serious answer to that?
Yeah.
Bill, money, okay?
Yeah.
This doesn't have a good godforsaken thing to do with national security or protecting freedom or keeping us safe from the terrorists. There is a huge cadre of profiteering, amoral, soulless, money-grubbing, multi-billionaire pissants who come up with these lunatic schemes, these anti-constitutional, not unconstitutional, anti-constitutional schemes, and then go to people who are embedded in the government and have been embedded in the government since the Bush administration. And maybe since the first Bush administration. Remember how Cheney who bragged about how they were leaving moles deep inside the federal government?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? He wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
And so you get these people who say, well, you know, what we need to do is spend about $92 billion on a supercomputing data acquisition center that can then spy on everybody's phone call, and that way
Nobody who's using Sprint or Verizon or AT&T would dare plot to blow up your local Walmart.
Yeah, and the
guy on his opposite on the government side says, by jinkies, that's a great idea. Let me sign off on that. And then promptly retires from government and gets a job with Booz Allen Hamilton. That just happens to be the story of Michael McCurry?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that happened.
Yeah. That was an interesting conversation in the second, in the last part of the program last night. Because that, what's it, Breitbart?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I still wonder if somebody just didn't strangle the bastard.
Well, granted, he had it coming, but...
There's a potential there.
I think he was just abusing drugs.
Well, would that surprise you?
No, not a dime's worth.
Me neither, because I've seen people from all walks of life get themselves involved with the, I was very differential in my life about what I would mess with and what I wouldn't, and I kept up a family tradition with the, and something that Barry Goldwater would have approved of. I saw him on television. I think it was with Leno speaking about the substance that grows wild in Arizona.
Yes.
How minor a thing it is, because it grows loose all over the place and has been around forever. And
probably the single most useful piece of vegetative matter ever to grow on the face of planet Earth.
Yeah, I remember my mother going to the doctor to lose some weight, and she comes home with a nice bottle full of Dexedrine. And I remember once when I was delivering milk. Being a milkman when you're 21 is tough, Bob. To get up at that hour of the morning when you're out the night before, you know. And I would take one of those things and go do my job, come home, and never touch another one. Because that was something I saw devastate my generation, was a speed, legal or otherwise. In fact, if you go back far enough, guys were breaking open inhalers that were soaked in Benzedrine.
See, I remember that great Don Williams song. It's a favorite of mine, Good Old Boys Like Me. And there's a line in there where he sings, when I was a kid, I ran with a kid. When I was a boy, I ran with a kid up the street, and I watched him burn himself up on bourbon speed.
Yeah. Speed was a very popular item because doctors would throw it at anybody who went there complaining about their weight. Instead of saying, well, cut down on what you eat and exercise more, here, take this. And, of course, you could get a lot done, I suppose, under those, you know, idea, but and from what I heard, guys that were flying out of England to go after Germany in World War II, that stuff was
available. that was the era, though, Bill, of better living through chemistry.
Yeah.
What's that? Having a rough pregnancy? Try this thalidomide.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, that's the way the I told you this story, but when my first wife was working in a psych hospital and the shrink got all upset over some woman who complained she couldn't tell my wife that one patient must be having a rough time. She said she couldn't hear because she didn't have her glasses. When hearing aids were being built into eyeglasses as a way of selling more of them to people who were self-conscious about them, and somebody was manufacturing lettuce leaf cigarettes. I can't think of the name of them. They were around for a while. They didn't take off too well because people were missing the point that the reason you smoked cigarettes was not to have smoke coming out of your nose. There was nicotine. Nicotine is a very, very... in fact, for a while, the doctor gave me these inhalers, little plastic things, looked like cigarette holders.
Oh, yeah, I remember those, the nicotine inhalers.
Yeah, they were handy.
Yeah, I never, they never did anything. Well, I've had all manner of trouble quitting smoking.
You and cigarettes too, huh? Yeah, well, but
it's interesting. I've never had any other addiction.
Me too. That was it for me. Well, that and working in bars full of attractive young women was a tough.
You were in a business where, as crazy as it may seem, you being a harp player and everything.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get your blues union card without a Nicotine Jones, can you?
I don't think so. Most of the guys I knew were smokers. I mean, musicians, and worse, two of them, the prizes of my youth. One was a very rich young man from Chicago who's. According to the guy who drummed with him, this guy's family owned a company that made the very expensive coffee pots that sit on, you know, you see them in restaurants where they're connected to the water.
Oh, yeah, the buns.
Yeah. Well, this is a name that starts with a B also, but and his, according to this drummer, this kid's folks had a patent on the squeeze ketchup and mustard bottle. Now, there is money.
A patent?
Yep. They developed it. They came up with it and were able to get a patent on it. And, you know, because a patent, you get a patent on something in this country and you're fixed for the next five generations, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But getting back to this thing, now, you know, I just was going through a book by Max Hastings, a great one-volume study of the whole mess in World War II, and the title is, let me look at it again, because I can't remember my own name some nights, Inferno. And he covered that Japanese Naval Unit 731 that was working in Harbin, Manchuria, and they were doing all kind of who was the German, Mengele? They were involved in the same type of thing the Mengele was, and they were using a lot of germ warfare. And something I picked up through the book this time, which I missed, that's the thing about audiobooks, you know. You take your mind off it for a second, you just miss something. The Japanese had a ship bound for Saipan loaded with the little germies and of various types. And the ship sank, or was sunk, on its way to Saipan, where the American Marines were involved in a rude discussion with the Japanese Army. That's why it's so hard. I have a real problem with the nuclear weapon deal.
By the way, you just got a note in. You struck a nerve with Jim. Lettuce leaf cigarettes, sativa. Ugh, 1975.
Oh.
So Jim can apparently date it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like I said once before, that's too early for my time, but I remember by about 1980, they were trying to foist off upon a credulous public cigarettes made from cocoa bean husks.
Oh. Yeah, anything you can come up with and advertise. You might sell enough of it to make a nice profit on it. Because the short-term profit is the king of the American, economic area.
Well, what's fascinating is the cocoa bean ones were called free.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the abstract says, It was one of those instances of profiteering first and thinking later.
Yeah.
One, these things tasted like poo. Not that I know. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
But the abstract says, pyrolysis of cocoa beans releases many of the same constituents that are released by the pyrolysis of tobacco. Cocoa bean extracts, manufacturers of Bogart, predecessor to free cigarettes and free, claimed a health warning was not necessary. However, laboratory tests show tar levels greatly exceeding that of Marlboro.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, if you remember, every once in a while I catch some of these old, a buddy of mine will send me a bunch of old radio broadcasts, and the good ones leave the commercials in, Bob. And you hear this stuff they were throwing at people in the radio broadcasting days. I think today all I hear is insurance commercials, you know, on television, on cell phones. And of course, I have a hard time finding a cell phone that's big enough for a person with vision problems. I wish I still had that bag. I wish I had that old bag, but they think it was my second wife, you know. The bag phones were easy to use. You had to carry it in your car and lock it in your trunk.
Oh, see, I remember those things. Our first child was on the way when cell service first came to town, and I had a bag phone. It was about the size of, you know, a purse.
Yep.
And I carried it everywhere I went in case Agnes went into labor.
Well, isn't it? But see, that's a... I'm telling you, that's something worth having a phone for.
The thing is, at that point in time, the vast majority of calls that were made on cellular networks consisted of the following. Hey, guess where I'm calling from? Yeah, my car. No, really.
As if that really meant anything in itself. It was the communications. It was a handy device when you broke down somewhere, and like me in the middle of it, and it never really happened to me. I was a...
The service was like $1 million a month or something, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, my second wife was one. If you tried to sell it to her, she'd buy it. You know, which led to problems when you're married to a guy like me who is a terminal cheapskate.
Right, and with the old bag phones, if you zigged instead of zagged coming out your front door, you'd be roaming.
Yeah, one of my best friends works in, he works in Chicago. And he was making a lot of money at one time until a company got rid of him and hired two kids for one-third each of what he was making. And the extra third, the boss put in his own retirement account, which is almost typical of what's going on in the capitalist area today. Lay off people, hire cheaper ones, and add this money you saved to your own situation. That's what's helping them. Because to me, the lack of jobs in this country that pay a living wage, there's no way out of it. That it's a problem that's going to keep growing and growing. And then you've got you mentioned the name Sensenbrenner. Man, I remember that name from the past. I think.
I think he goes all the way back to covering up for Uncle Ronnie when Uncle Ronnie got caught peeing all over the Constitution with the Iran-Contra affair.
Yeah.
And I know he was involved in the great Clinton penis witch hunt.
People probably think I'm a lying idiot, but I have met with...
People do not think you're lying, Bill.
Well, I bumped into a lot of people.
That's a joke.
The one bar owner that I worked for, his wife had a brother who was working in Tehran, Iran in 1980. In the embassy, and he was a hostage. And I didn't know him that well, but I just happened to know somebody that was related to him. It's when you think it's a small world after a while, Bob. I'm sure you can say the same thing about people you've met. And doing commercials for Roger Ailes produced a couple of very negative political commercials. I bumped into him by accident and got a job from him to play. Things were called signs of the times. One was a bunch of kids throwing rocks at schools, and the other was American Eagle exploding in fire and smoke.
Well, Jesus, he hadn't changed, has he?
No, it was the same crapola. And, of course, it was 7 minutes of my time for $100. I wish I could do that every day, you know. And you didn't think anything of it. But they were panned. Newsweek had a small mention of them within 3 or 4 months. It was a... it was to support Saxby when he ran for Senate here in Ohio. It was just one of those things. You keep bumping into people by accident, and later on they turn out to be... And I'm sure you had it, because you were in radio for many years. And you probably, met some people that, unfortunately they're not the kind to help you with anything, are they?
Once upon a time I used to get the occasional voiceover gig.
You've got it.
Way back in the bad old days at CNN, every now and then they'd come around and get me to do the intro to Larry King Live or Crossfire. you know, that paid you like an extra $25. And they, it wasn't 7 minutes of work for $100. These guys were merciless. They'd have you there for 30 minutes, you know, take 212 tonight on Crossfire. We want more on, could we have a little bit more on the night tonight on Crossfire?
It's insane to get what they think they want. Well, in my case, it was just a very simple music job, so it was nothing, you know. I used to like commercial work. It was usually quick and easy, and nobody was too drunk yet.
Yeah, I used to get to do Welcome to Larry King's Sweater Live. Tonight, Larry's Sweater Vest welcomes... Yeah.
You know, I used to listen to that guy late at night.
Oh, he was great on radio. Yes. TV was the worst thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah. He had an author of a book. It was a book that I ended up buying and owning. It was a study of what's his name, the general that got stuck in Bataan, Wainwright. It was a study of Wainwright's career. Wainwright had been an old cavalry general before the war, and he got the command of the Pacific, the Philippine Division. Right before December, you know, within the last year before December 7th, and he had to, he was the guy that had to surrender Corregidor to the Japanese, and he made a great speech. John Tolan did a book on him, too. You go through these books and you keep learning more and more stuff. As I say, the stuff you were talking about tonight, this is... And I don't know why, was it us that we figured that just the politicians that we liked, that we basically started out liking and supporting and being willing to vote for, that they now seem to fall right into the pockets of the upper classes. And they do what, you know, because I suppose, because there are people, there are things written that... we had broken JN-25, which was the Japanese naval code, and I can proudly say that the guys that really had a lot to do with the setting up, not the Coral Sea, the other one, the big sea battle.
Midway.
There was a lot of out-of-work musicians at Pearl. They were out of work because their battleships were either totally destroyed forever or sitting at the bottom of... Pearl. In fact, I read a good talking book on that subject written by... But you keep wondering, where the hell... See, me, I know where I'm headed. The exit door is a lot closer than the entrance door. But I keep wondering how the rest of you guys are going to deal with this stuff. And then you would...
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because every time... And I bet you grandparents can... Just about every grandparent can say this. Every time you see your grandchildren when they're little, you wonder a little bit more about what their world is going to look like.
Yeah.
And even more so than your own children, your grandchildren make you feel this intense urge to protect.
Yeah. Because of the tiny and the future. And...
Yeah. I think there's a certain gravity that attaches to grandchildren, because it's like, wow, I reproduced, now the kids reproduced, and holy mackerel, you know, we're three generations. Good God.
Yeah.
And you want to, you know, like that Queen song that Ron and Raleigh sent along, and Isaac tweeted, and he said, that Ron and Raleigh's pretty damn deep. That Ron and Raleigh is pretty damn deep. But... You know, I know there are those who see this as a veil of tears, and the sooner we shuffle off the mortal coil, the better. And I get frustrated because I want to, and it's not like there's anything I don't think that's imminent or pending or anything like that. It's just a recognition of mortality, but. I don't walk out on movies even when they're terrible.
Well, I have some problems.
And if I start a book, even including the utterly unreadable, miserable Atlas Shrugged, I finish the goddamn thing. It's just something about me. And like the news story with the Green News Report a few minutes ago, Bill.
I don't want to
revel in anybody's misery. I'd rather try to be around to be of some help. And I guess the trick is to raise that next generation and the generation after them so that they can be of some help and not be part of the problem. Because we've got easily half of this country that is more willing to be part of the problem than part of the solution.
Yes.
And the ones who aren't part of the problem are oblivious and even by their ignorance become part of the problem.
Well,
you know, there's drill baby drill, there's the drill baby drill types, and then there are the people who say, I don't give a damn where it comes from as long as I can get it for, as long as I can fill up the tank for less than $100.
Yeah.
And these are the same people who think electricity comes from the wall socket and meat comes from the grocery store.
You know, I haven't been driving since 2002, actually, like January. And I was still able to pick up gasoline here and there every once in a while for a buck a gallon. And people say, oh, that's a long time ago. Not really so long, because when I was 9 or 10, it was 28.9.
And yeah, that would be about the time that I was... Well, the cheapest gasoline I remember is a sign that said 29.9, because my father had to explain the last nine to me.
Yeah.
Why isn't it just 29 cents, Dad? Well, because the oil companies can make more money on that 9/10 of a penny.
Yeah. Well, I remember in Ohio when you didn't pump your own gas.
Sure. I remember,
yeah. It was 9.8, 9.7, you know. It's not that long ago in the reality of world time. Because we don't stick around that long. You know? We don't... something that happened 100 years ago to me is a wink in the history of the world.
I was thinking about that just the other day because of some reading I've been doing. I was calculating the distance between the reign of... Oh, well, it's the Nerd Hour with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the differential in time between the assassination of Julius Caesar and the rise of Constantine the Great. And that is roughly 375 years.
Yeah.
Now, 375 years, just to put that in some kind of context, that means... somewhere around 1630.
Yeah.
So imagine how much has changed here from 1630 to 2013, and then imagine the Roman world between 44 before the current era and 332 of the current era. The technological changes were not the same, because they've come much faster with the advent of the hydrocarbon age. But still, to even try to think about something like that, you know, we tend to lump history. You know, there's this thing, Bill, that we call history.
Yeah.
And it's everything that happened day before yesterday, all the way back to the rise of, you know, when the proto-humans started coming out of the trees. And that's a hell of a chunk. And we have a hard time differentiating. The transition from the state of civilization that the empire existed under to the Dark Ages. Can you imagine being on the cusp of that shit and seeing everything fall apart? Or would you even have noticed?
One of my classic movies is it's the one where the outlaws go down and rob a trainload of rifles in the Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
And they go pouring into riding into this
Mexican revolutionaries' camp to sell them the weapons, and here comes the German military attaché with the Mexican generalissimo riding in a big car. And the one old-timer in the bunch, they start talking about the car, and he says something, I hear back east they've got the machines that can fly. And, of course, the other guys all start poo-pooing them, you know. But you and I know exactly at that point in time, sometime around the German military attaché, it was around the First World War when that stuff took place in the movie. And, my God, yeah, they were coming. Hell, the British developed the first ships capable of launching planes from in that First World War era. You know, and the Germans, they had the dirigible, the Zeppelin, and they were throwing bombs out of those things. What is it with human beings? We come up with something new, and one of the first things we find what to do with it is to go after somebody else with it.
And I was explaining that very principle to Ferg the other day, the fact that every time we come up with a weapon, the inventor of the weapon says, well, I didn't invent this to make a lot of money. I invented this to make sure that the weapon will be so horrible nobody will ever use it against someone.
Yeah.
And you know, that's Alfred Nobel and TNT. That's the Gatling gun.
Yep.
That's probably everything back to sharp sticks.
Well, I have to explain to people that, yeah, the Union Army had access to the coffee mill gun, you know, the hopper, and you crank it.
Yeah.
But the chief of ordnance for the Union Army was a guy named Ripley. And he was a tightwad and a cheapskate. He thought that kind of weapon, these guys would just waste bullets. And he never brought it to the... I don't think it ever took part in any major engagement I ever read about. And I think I've read them and walked the battlefields, most of them. But the Union Army, by the end of that war, repeating carbines, cavalrymen had...
Oh, you mean that damn Yankee rifle you load on Sunday and shoot all week?
All week, that's the one, yeah. Because, Bob, I hate to say this, and what's his name? I hope he's not listening. Our buddy, who you just mentioned his name.
Isaac?
No, not Isaac. Yeah, he gives me enough trouble. But with Isaac, it's fun. He can insult you so well, you sit there and laugh at it yourself. It's done so pleasantly and so intelligently. Your regular caller.
Jim.
Jim. Because I know, because my feeling is that what was in those guys south of the Mason-Dixon line that when you looked at the things they thought they could walk away? I mean, I hate to say this, but the South never won a really major battle west of the mountains.
You know? No.
Never did. It was Lee and Longstreet and Jackson and Hill and that bunch in the Army of Northern Virginia that seemed to be able to handle things very well, too well. And when you look at pictures of Petersburg, Virginia, all I can think of is the Western Front in 1914 or 15, you know? All its entrenchments. And...
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to the original...
Well, I was going to tell you, before we move on, I wanted to share a piece of humor with you. You know, I'm a daily reader of Charlie Pierce over at...
he's a funny man.
And smart, too.
Yes.
And in describing, you know, there's a coming fight in Washington over the fact that the Kenyan Muslim socialist is actually trying to be president of the United States and appointing people to fill vacancies on various and sundry seats on the bench.
Yep.
And this has now been described by the right wing as court packing. Now, never mind the fact that Saint Ronnie of Raygun, that greasy-headed old B-movie actor terrorist. Never mind the fact that he put more people on the bench than you and I could begin to count in a month of Sundays. The fact that the Kenyan Muslim wants to be president and do president things, well, that's court packing. So, lo and behold, Charlie takes off writing today about the coming fight over the D.C. Circuit Court. because it's got vacancies on it that he's nominated to people to fill.
And they won't vote on it.
No, they won't vote on it. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because of the name that Charlie Pierce brought up. He refers to, and I've referred to him on this program, simply by his real-life, no-kidding, given name, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the Hood.
Oh, that guy.
Okay. Dumber than a handful of hammers, handles.
Yep.
To Charlie Pierce, he is now Senator Jefferson Beauregard Longstreet Lee Stuart Hill Early Sidney Johnson Foghorn Culpepper Calhoun Sessions of Alabama.
Wonderful.
Isn't that beautiful?
Wonderful piece of work, yeah. The bells, you start those names and the bells are going off on me.
And just tucking that foghorn down in there somewhere along the way is beautiful.
Well, foghorn, leghorn.
It might have been absolute satiric perfection if he'd thrown in a corn pone into the bargain.
Yeah.
You know, say maybe Jefferson Beauregard, Longstreet, Corn Pone, Lee Stuart Hill, Early Sidney Johnson, Foghorn, Culpepper, Calhoun. Yeah.
Well, you know the Fred Allen, the radio comic, when he had the Allen's Alley, one of the habitués of Allen's Alley was Senator Cleghorn, who was a stereotypical heavy accented big mouth.
Right.
And that's when they turned around, I think, and developed the cartoon character.
That's where Foghorn Leghorn came from.
Yep. Well, I say my favorite Fred Allen line was that he didn't cut it in television at all. But his favorite line, and I'll let you go after this, because it describes television to this day perfectly. Something for people with nothing to do to watch people who can do nothing. If it wasn't for professional football and such, what's on television today? Do I have to see some of these mythical stories, as I was speaking the other day about Amish gangsters, or
yeah,
what do? Throw eggs at you? Or what?
Anyway, no, they sneak in and cut your beard by night. They really did that.
Yeah, that's another.
That's another Ohio story.
Another type of a religious fanaticism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew a woman who was an ex, grew up Amish, and
yeah, they seem so benign.
Yeah.
But they're not.
Yeah. Well, this woman really went against the grain stereotypically, and that was fine with me. Well, in a way, maybe not so, because it's a tough situation.
By the way, Bill, you channeled the Wild Bunch fans in the audience.
Oh.
And the Horn family. Irish Dave says, best line in the Wild Bunch. How is it out there? Well, it's not like it was, but it'll do.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a few things that were done in that era where they gave you a look backwards at people who were looking forward and seeing things that were coming. Because that's the whole thing. I wish I had, if I had known what I should have known, you know. Well, they told me stay in school, get that college degree, blah, blah. I don't think I'd been a match for Dr. Bill even if I had. But it would have been a better pension at this point, you understand?
Oh, sure. But no, I know what you're talking about, because when I was a little boy, I had a fascination with aircraft, and I would stand and look up at the sky every time I heard an engine going over, and because back then, before airline deregulation, we had a busy little airport across the river, so there was always something in the sky. Somebody was flying into the shoals. A lot of industry there, that kind of thing. By the way, McDonald's has decided to buy a new luxury corporate jet, while at the same time decrying the fact that if they paid a nickel more on the hour to their workers, they'd surely go broke. But anyway, one of those occasions, it was actually up here, and I was looking at a plane go over, and my grandmother told me the story of the first time she ever saw an aircraft in the air. Because for some reason or another, this little area gave rise to one of West Virginia's and an early American aviator. And she said she thought the world had come to an end.
Yeah, because when you see this stuff, you think you've seen it all. I mean, the air races were big here in Cleveland in the late 40s after the war. And
Right across from this bar that I worked for many years, there was a big building that had been a place where they built the Ford Trimotor. And they were still flying those Trimotors out of the Lake Erie Islands back to the mainland in my lifetime. They were still flying those damn things.
Right.
The planes were... the planes I enjoyed...
Romantic as hell, fascinating.
Well, the ones I enjoyed the most were going up there with polarized glasses and a pair of binoculars and a map of the lake I was fishing. Because you could see all the weed beds and the accesses to deep water, and you started marking your map. And because, believe it or not, there's a science to everything in this world, and that even includes going out and finding out how to catch fish when you go. Because me, I always enjoyed bringing back a year's worth of frozen panfish fillets because they sure tasted good.
I'll tell you what, I've got a little secret to share. I ran across some manager's special walleye at Kroger's the other day.
Ooh. Don't tell people where it is in the neighborhood. You'll start a...
Well, no, I got it all.
Oh, good, good. Yeah.
Stuff was regular $12 a pound, and it was marked down to like $5.
Ooh.
And grabbed a head of cabbage, a jar of dill relish, an onion, a green pepper, and a jar of mayonnaise, made my homemade tangy tartar sauce.
Oh, yeah.
And you want to talk about some happy campers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I forget what it was. There was a Lake Erie fish of some kind that blew. I forget what it was called, but it was advertised all over the place in the 50s and 60s. Man, it was so extinct from Lake Erie because Erie got so damn polluted. It isn't now because there's tons of a lot of smallmouth bass out there, but of course that pollution, the end of that pollution, unfortunately, the thing that went with that was the end of factory paychecks. Because that's part of why I think they go overseas with whatever they want, because they can go to China and the government lets them pollute like crazy. What they can't get away with here anymore. It cuts in anything that cuts into profit by one tenth of 1% is enough to drive people away and to find a place they can. Well, I'm not telling you anything, that's for sure. Because that's the shame of it. Because I know, I think I said something to you about coal had. I don't know what the hell else would they have used, Bob.
It was, well, coal was a necessity to the rise of industrialism.
Yeah.
The Roman word for it translated was jet. And, you know, we have jet black, you know. Well, jet was a word for something that was intensely black to the Roman culture. It really doesn't come into its own until... sometime in the early second millennium of the Common Era, Britain has essentially deforested itself.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, at the very same time, on the other side of the Atlantic, a culture that was arguably far superior to the white European culture on the island of Great Britain had also deforested itself. And that was the Mayan culture of Central America.
Yep.
You know how rich those jungles are. Imagine how hard you have to work to deforest Central America.
Yeah.
Well, they had, just as the island of Great Britain had been deforested, just as the Iberian Peninsula had been deforested, just as big swaths of Western Europe had been deforested. The only thing was those enterprising people on the so-called Sceptred Isle found this stuff sticking out of the ground that just happened to burn if you lit it.
Yeah.
And that is the origin of coal. The original word for coal as manifested among the speakers of English was sea coal, S-E-A-C-O-A-L. And it was so called because it was transported by coastal barge from where it was mined to where it was burnt. And that was the means by which, where the Mayan culture collapsed as a result of deforestation and the resulting erosion, the British culture did not. because they had a substitute for wood, because wood did not replenish in a timely fashion.
A long time to regrow those trees.
Yeah. And so it wasn't very long at all, a couple of hundred years, before people figured out that burning that stuff was, in fact, toxic.
Yep.
And the king issued an edict at some point in time forbidding the burning of coal within within the town limits of London.
Mm.
Because London had become unlivable.
Yeah, I can believe that, because it was... I lived next to a... the projects I lived in had 654 suites. In fact, Eleanor Roosevelt opened, came down to cut the ribbon. That was before my time by a... Well, opened in 39. I didn't take a walk out here until... Well, I wasn't carried around until 43. And but here the problem with coal is the same problem. If you're crooked on top of something that pollutes by itself, and you don't give a shit how many people die in the process of mining it, or you don't give a damn how disgusting it makes the, you know, then you don't look for anything else. Like, I hear all the people who are against windmills and against this and against that. And it's like...
But these, you know, these hydrocarbon fools are against windmills the way buggy whip manufacturers were against automobiles.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's going to cut into their profit.
Right, and there's no way to whip an automobile the way you can whip a horse.
Yeah, and I have friends who have sold property to the... sold rights to the frackers, and I just keep telling them, you're going to be sorry. Because they're a lot younger than me. I said, we don't know. Because if you give these guys a right to go make a dollar, they can't make the dollar straight up. They got to cheat to increase. There used to be a TV show, Police Story, with a retired cop playing the lead of a detective. And it was in Chicago before they went to Vegas. And the one guy, one gangster, opens a bottling company. But as you followed it, he had to do something to this pop that he was bottling so he could make a little more profit per bottle. I mean, these guys carry it to an extreme.
Well, it's the story of economies of scale.
Yeah.
And if you're making a million of something, if you can shave a half a penny off of it, well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the story of the rise of high fructose corn syrup in the American diet.
Yes.
That was all born out of the Coca-Cola Corporation's desire to wring the necks of its local bottlers. The local bottlers had become magnates in their own right.
Yeah.
Bottling the stuff.
Yeah.
And by using high fructose corn syrup, Coca-Cola was able to force the bottlers who were using sugar to lose money. And so most if not all of the independent bottlers were driven out of business by a new subsidiary called Coca-Cola USA.
Okay.
And all of this has its genesis in the 1985 introduction, as I've mentioned before, of New Coke. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, that fell on.
You know, Pepsi-flavored Coke.
Yeah.
The Coca-Cola company did not give a damn about New Coke. It had nothing to do with the marketing bullshit of trying to make a flavor that was more... No, this was the transition to high-fructose corn syrup that would then break the local bottlers.
Well, I sometimes wonder if I'm imagining things or the Coke that... Those small bottles that I got out of the machine in 1951 were different. They had a bite to them compared to the stuff today, and I think probably was the sugar.
Yeah, well, sugar ask a friend of yours, somebody, when they go to the grocery store... Or go to one of the. I'm sure in Cleveland you have the little Mexican tiendas.
Yeah, Mexican Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had some a couple of years ago, and it bit me. It bit.
Yeah, throw a little splash of rum, a little squeeze of lime over ice with that. It's like time travel.
Boy, don't talk to me about rum. A buddy of mine did some crewing. The last time I talked to him, he was selling yachts in Florida. He had been a bass player, average. But he got a job.
Wait, a bass player with a working job?
Yeah, well, I did that. I was good at having steady work.
No, it's the drummer that never has work, right?
Yeah. Well, this guy sells yachts, and he'd go down, he'd crew on them, and he brought some rum back from the islands. with the strange sounding name of Old Mount Gay, which today would open up another door.
Yeah. No, Mount Gay Barbados rum is a big deal.
It was a son of a... Ooh.
Yeah, that or Barbancourt from Haiti, and, of course, Havana Club from Cuba. Just, you know, there's a... Let's put it this way. There's a reason that is on the Bacardi label.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's distilled bat piss as compared to a Barbancourt or a Mount Gay or a Myers's or a... Havana Club.
You can't get that stuff up here, no doubt.
Oh no, the Havana Club, forget it.
Yeah,
I thought about trying to sneak a bottle in from Amsterdam, but then realized, you know, anything that gurgled would probably get me busted. So I decided I would protect the Cuban cigars that I was sneaking in by not giving them anything else to be curious about.
Well, I talked to you. I had a taste for a gin gimlet, so I found a Rose's lime juice, but then the person at the health aid that was shopping with me, she gets a bottle of that 40% gin, and get this stuff out of here. I mean, I'm not a drunk, but I'll be damned if I want to have a drink, I want to have a drink.
Oh, she didn't get slow gin, did she?
No, it was just name Paramount or one of those crap. I mean, gin was, to me, was Tanqueray or... what was the American gin that was...
Well, Tanqueray, Beefeater.
Beefeater.
Yeah. I was always a fan of Bombay. There's a new one out, though, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's a cucumber-infused gin.
Mm.
And it's ungodly expensive, but it's interesting. Now, as far as a good bargain basement gin is concerned, mm. New Amsterdam.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. But, you know, the problem is up here... Well, I shouldn't say it's a problem. You still have to go to the liquor store. The stuff they have in the supermarkets is cut-rate, cut-alcohol. Not that I really need to get a booze, you know. I haven't.
No, but you want it to be what you're meant it to be.
Yeah. Well, that was a funny...
Well, you'll go... Next thing you know, Bill, you'll go from wanting a gimlet to having a hankering for a Gibson.
Oh, really well.
That's gin, dry vermouth, and a pearl onion. That's the pearl onion is what delineates it from a martini.
Well, it's like trying to find a good beer, but there are good beers being brewed in these micros now that...
Yeah, you just have to be careful to make sure that the micro hasn't already been absorbed by one of the big brewing conglomerates.
True. I mean, you wave a beer around somebody with German antecedents, you know, their tongue starts coming out. It's just, I mean, the classic was that when the Germans took over Tsing Tao on the coast of China as their, you know, a concession they got from the royalty to put their navy in there, and they had to start brewing their own beer or they're to hell with it. You know, German sailors, yeah, we're going to brew our own stuff. I can't find Tsing Tao anymore either. Although it's Red Chinese brewed now.
Well, it's out there, though. It's out there. Hey, Bill, it's been a wonderful conversation. Ahead.
Take care of yourself, my friend. I hope there's some good folk lined up to talk.
All right.
Take care.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, Bill, calling from Cleveland. Had a note in from our buddy Robert in Australia a few minutes ago. He said, hey, Bob, I got $50 for tonight's fundraising if somebody else will match the 50. So that would be a big help. We're at $245 and holding for the past while. If somebody or some combination of somebody's will pitch in $50, Robert in Australia will match it so that we'll knock that down to 145. PayPal button, you know where it is, headonradionetwork.com. So, there's that. I wanted to share something with you real quick. Before going back to the phone lines, I've had this actually for a while, and I knew that at some point in time it would be especially useful. Bill talking about the early days of flight and everything reminded me of it. I had a note back toward the end of September from our buddy Jay in Yuma. And things that put a larger put a perspective on the larger scope of things always speak to me, and things that draw what seem like vast spaces in time and compact them really really have an impact on me. And back when Jay was helping us out of the massive financial crisis that nearly took us off the air back at the end of September, he sent this along. Get this. This is magnificent. Jay says, my father was born in 1883. His father was a teenager during the Lincoln administration. Grandfather Reeder's family lived in Missouri, where the Civil War tore apart neighbors and even families who had different views of which side was the right side. 17-year-old William Paul Reeder refused to take sides. He instead put a pack on his back and left Missouri walking west. That eventually took him to the Colorado Territory, where he settled. My father was born there in Durango, the first of five children. A few miles south in New Mexico Territory, but some 20 years later, in 1904, Narcissa Maria Rice, the woman who would become my mother, was born. About that time, as the new 20th century began to unfold, young Elton Felix Reeder left home in search of opportunities and fortune. Railroad expansion was everywhere in the West, and Elton worked in and around a number of rail companies before hooking up with the Continental Oil Company. You might recognize Continental Oil Company by its later acronym, Conoco. When Henry Ford's Model T began to appear in large numbers, an instant demand was created for gasoline. Conoco recognized this and embarked on a campaign to build gas stations all over the West to fill this need. Elton was soon heading up that project in the area that included Kansas, Nebraska, and eastern Colorado. One of the gas station construction foremen, a Kansas farmer named Stan something or other, and Elton became good friends. At the end of World War I, they threw in together and bought a surplus Packard aircraft engine. In the barn on Stan's farm, during their spare time, they built a biplane and survived learning to fly it. And fly it they did, from hopping around between construction sites to weekend partying in Denver and Omaha. For Christmas of 1922, Elton decided to fly home to Durango to reconnect with the family. His arrival, flying his own airplane, created quite a stir. One young woman took particular notice. While visiting friends in Durango, she met this sharply dressed adventurer during a holiday party. Outfitted in full flapper regalia, 19-year-old Narcissa stood out as well. In spite of wagging tongues about the 20 years age difference, they were married before the next year ended. They had two sons, and then after a gap of 12 years, one more. I was born in 1943 when my father was 4 months shy of his 60th birthday. That marriage lasted until my father's death in 1968, the result of injuries sustained in a bad fall. He slipped on some ice on his way to work. At the time, he and my mother were running a Continental Swiss pastry shop and bakery in Aspen. Bob, I wrote that a little bio of my parents years ago. Now a bit about my outlook on how my outlook on life came about. Early in my life, my father explained to me that people are more important than possessions. Also, he made clear that all living things deserve a chance to pursue a way to make their living on this planet. He further expounded that the difference between we humans and a beetle crawling across the sidewalk basically comes down to little more than a roll of the genetic dice. The fact that we ended up with the ability to do so does not necessarily give us the right to dominate lesser life forms, but rather it should obligate us to care for them. I'll try to add more on this at a later date, but for now, I'll again fall back on previous writing. And he provides a short story, some 15 years old, a factual account of an event ripped from his own life, and we will go to that story on another evening. What a way to experience time itself. To know that you're connected to the earliest days of the middle part of the 19th century. That will provide, you know, that kind of continuity provides a greater sense, I think, than maybe the disconnectedness of the American so-called nuclear family. Because as Joe Bajant points out in Rainbow Pie, I referenced that last night as well, there was a concerted effort after the Second World War to disassociate people from their roots. It had to be done in order to create the massive consumer juggernaut that rules this country to this day. Thank you, Jude. Thank you very much. Jude just stepped up and met Robert's challenge. So that's going to take us down to $145 to raise to come even with the end of the evening itself. Thank you. Thank you, Jude. And thank you, Robert. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. That can only be one person.
Who that?
That would be you, Jim.
How are you?
I'm well, but better now.
Glad. It is the season of the witch.
It is indeed.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, I heard Bill mention my name. I don't know what he was saying about it. It was something with a thirst or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, if Bill's listening.
And he is.
You can tell him, or I'll tell him straight up, that, you know, we Southerners are very much like the Chinese. We worship our ancestors.
Yeah, I think I kind of manifested that just now, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. That's what sort of brought that to mind. Actually, it did. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that you read there, particularly with this guy being so involved with early aviation.
Well, I love how he describes his father and his buddy building the airplane and surviving learning to fly it.
Well, you know, my dad was a member of the OX-5, which is the Pioneer Aviators of America. And so he flew from a very early age in the 20s. And actually, this was after, I think, he got out of college or when he was still in college, but at some point during the summers, you know, he would do some of that stuff, like walking on wings, barnstorming, that type thing.
Yeah.
And I just asked him, I said, how in the world did you have the courage to do that? And he says, well, I was just crazy enough. And it was a strange point. That's where he met my mother, at one of those air shows. And, of course, she was advised not to give him a date because he was just too wild and too crazy.
Right, but it was all dreadfully romantic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you really, a guy who's got the nerve and the, you know, the spirit and the genica to get out there and do that without a parachute, I mean, it's just unheard of. And I still have some pictures of him standing in the cockpit of one of those old biplanes. And, you know, it's just amazing how these people have the courage to fly by the seat of their pants, literally, and did.
Well, you know, of course, that for the tourist trade around here, and he kind of more or less shuts down during after golly season closes, you know there's a guy who maintains a 1943 trainer biplane over in Fayetteville, don't you?
Uh-uh.
You can, especially on pretty spring and summer and autumn days, you can see him and you can hear him before you ever see him, because there's no mistaking the sound of that rotary engine It's a Boeing, and it's painted blue and gold.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives, you know, he gives rides, and he does. If you want the aerobatics, he'll do the aerobatics with you. That was a birthday present for Ferg that couldn't be delivered until good flying weather. But he's never been through anything like that in his life. It was a life changing experience for him.
You let Ferg go up in that plane?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you.
I mean, it's meticulously maintained, and he's got his own airstrip there in Fayetteville,
How old is this guy?
Oh, I'd say he's probably in his mid-40s.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know.
I mean, he's also a life flight pilot in the medical field, so.
Right. And he did all the aerial acrobatics with your son in the Rio seat?
In the forward position.
Oh, okay.
He does the piloting from the rear position. It's a tail dragger, and yeah, he went up and did Immelmann's and Hammerheads and you know, all the fun stuff.
Well, that man has a lot of courage because I tell you, my dad saw a lot of people who went up and didn't come down back in those days. You know, stalling out and things of that nature. Of course, I remember I did some flying myself just as a part of training and you know.
Well, the other plane that he maintains there, Jim, is one of those classic old World War II era air recon Pipers. You know, with the full open side for photography purposes.
Oh yeah. You know, I'm going to tell you something. As far as, you know, I did that when I was very young, younger. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I could not wait till I got back on the ground. And that was the reason I knew that I could never be a pilot. It, you know, even though I did it, I had to do it, passed and stuff like that, I just, elected not to do that anymore because I knew that if I did, I wouldn't be coming back. Something intuitively told me that.
Well, from the time I was tiny, I always wanted to learn to fly. And my discomfort with flying has absolutely nothing to do with the principle involved. It's the realization that modern air transportation is nothing more than well, I mean, at least the Europeans were honest about it. You know, they call their aircraft the Airbus. It's a big bus 40,000 feet in the air.
Well, of course, yeah.
And my difficulties stem from the difficulties I have in cabs, on boats, in planes, on buses themselves, and in plain old passenger automobiles. If I'm not behind the wheel, I am painfully uncomfortable.
There are a lot of people like that. Who, if the, you know,
I hate not being in control of things.
Yeah, it's a control factor, and you don't like to be at the mercy of somebody else. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I don't mind if somebody else is driving. You know, if I realize that you know they're a competent driver and stuff like that, because I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I just lost my love affair with the automobile. And, you know, being at the control of that wheel, it used to give me a lot of pleasure, but now it doesn't. I don't know why. You know, you change through the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Oh, Lord, back during my Halcyon sports car owning days, I loved nothing better than ripping up and down Golly Mountain on US 60, Porsche 911.
You're nuts. Going up in that thing, my Lord in heaven! I mean, what do you want to do? Become another James Dean?
Well, that was the beauty of driving that automobile. You know, with the engine in the rear, it's a different dynamic, and it's
still
tremendously exciting. I had a couple of buddies who had those, and we used to just sort of race up and down the mountain on Saturdays and Sundays.
Well, you ought to try a bat off mountain to do that. I'll tell you, because every tree on it at the bend of each road has a wreath on it.
Yeah.
Or somebody.
I know bat off mountain.
Oh, Lord.
And Bolt Mountain. You ever been over Bolt?
Mm-hmm. Sure have.
It's a joy.
No, it's not a joy. It's...
And frankly, the other side of US 60, the Midland Trail, going up and down Big and Little Sewell is pretty fun too.
Well, I don't know if I've been down that or not. I mean,
Rupert, Raynell.
Yeah, I think I have, and you know, and there are some roads that you go over, and it says beware of falling rocks, and you rocks are falling on the car that you're driving, and stuff like that. And at one point, because I was driving a federal vehicle, I had somebody take a shot at the car, and there was a bullet hole in the chassis, not the chassis, but the body of the car.
Nice.
I mean, you know, they see those federal plates and stuff like that.
It's a revenuer.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you. I don't know. But anyway, just for Bill's sake, yeah, he mentioned the Scythe, and I don't know what context he mentioned it in. I couldn't quite get it.
He was just talking about the whole question of the recent rebellion.
Oh, well. You know, that's just something that happened, and unfortunately, that's just the way it has turned out in our history. Like I said before, the North may have won the war, but the South won Reconstruction, so, you know, there it is. And, I don't know. There's just a number of things that are coming back and as far as secession and that type of thing is concerned. It's just not going to work. But there's some people who still think it is. I don't think it is. But I don't know. There are a number of forces at work which are inimical to the interests of the government. I saw something on the internet today about the Affordable Health Care Act. And I just turned on my computer and went to the internet, and there was a picture of Obama, and it was talking about how people who had purchased private insurance, you know, for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and apparently a number of these companies that sell this insurance to private companies, I'm not talking about group plans, when I first saw it, I immediately called Federal Blue Cross, and they said, no, you're not affected by this because we meet all the standards. But if you don't meet all the standards, then these people, and it's listed between like 40 and 67%, and then at the bottom of the article it said 80%, would be getting some nasty notes from their insurance company saying that their insurance coverage was going to go up significantly.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that as well, and it was generated by somebody over at NBC, and the reporting was more than a little bit sketchy. But what it boils down to is, in essence, it was anticipated that that insurance companies, lo and behold, and who could possibly imagine this, would behave like insurance companies.
Yeah, and they would probably increase the rates and premiums of the people who were not covered under group plans or those plans. And of course, all the group plans, I think, basically meet the standards of the law. But there are a lot of them who are being sold that are...
Right, and I continue with my thesis that the important part of the Affordable Care Act is the Medicaid expansion, which, of course, this story doesn't touch either.
Mm-mm. How is that going to go?
What do you mean?
Well, are they going to really increase that?
The way to look at that, Jim, is to go back and think about what the original intent was with Medicare.
Back in Medicare, when they passed that, you had people back even in the 60s saying they would have death panels and stuff like that.
Well, of course, every Republican opposed it, just like every Republican opposed Social Security. But had Vietnam not ruined LBJ, we so often remember LBJ for what he did to Vietnam and what Vietnam did to the country and what Vietnam did to his presidency. But it is well worth remembering, Jim, that his administration was largely responsible for some of the most profound social change that this country has known in the last 150 years. and, you know, the Great Society, the War on Poverty.
Right.
Those were his attempts to better the condition of workaday Americans. And so the way Medicare was envisioned was that, yes, just like Social Security was started out with a sort of narrow scope,
and then
it was expanded.
Mm-hmm.
So, too, Medicare would start out to be an old-age health care program for people 65 years and older, but then in a few years they would drop that to 60, and a few more years 55, and a few more years 50, until it was basically universal single-payer health care. That was the original intent behind Medicare.
But that didn't happen.
But that did not happen, and it did not happen in large part because his presidency was crippled by the foolhardiness of Vietnam. But to look at the Medicaid expansion, right now it's at 137% of the poverty level, and asset testing has been eliminated as of January 1.
Uh-huh.
So if you meet that income testing on January 1, if you're beneath that 137% threshold, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, single person or married couple or married with kids, however it works out. You know, like that candidate for political office in Idaho who is a teabagger and swears he hates government programs but has 10 children on SNAP benefits and Medicare. Well, you know, they're going to have that. If we ever get a sane Congress again, we can go back and say, look, the Affordable Care Act is not working for a lot of Americans. We need to up the level of Medicaid access. Take it from 137 to 150, 150 to 175, and if you get to 200% of the poverty level, you're going to be taking in a vast majority of working America.
But they haven't done that yet, have they?
Oh, no. This Congress is still busy swearing that it's the devil.
Well, the thing I want to ask you, and I'm not trying to be contentious here, but how do they intend to pay for this, given our other financial problems and stuff like that? It's like I said last night, you know, when they put everything on the table, there are no fenced funds and things of that nature or pots of money. I just wonder how do they intend to pay for this? I mean,
well, that's not entirely correct, Jim. For instance, when they were having their hissy over defunding the Affordable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act was written in such a way that they could have passed that bill, and even if the president had signed it into law, most of it would have still gone into effect because it was funded as an act of government. You know, Social Security, for instance, is not predicated on a lockbox or a trust fund or anything like that. It is predicated on the full faith and government, full faith and credit of the government.
Right.
I mean, that's why we have a sovereign currency. That's why, among other things, no matter how many times the right wing hollers about it, we can never be Greece. Remember when Eddie Munster from Janesville, Wisconsin, the recent vice presidential pageant winner, was running around saying, "We're going to be Greece, we're going to be Greece." Well, we weren't going to be Greece, and Greece wound up being Greece because Greece gave up the sovereignty of the drachma in favor of inclusion in the Eurozone. The dollar remains the single best currency and investment on the planet.
Well, for the time being, it does. But
I mean, the only thing that rivals it in size and scope is the euro, and nobody feels good about the euro.
Well, the thing about the dollar is this: its integrity is being threatened by a number of things that have happened, like government shutdowns and the sequester and things of that nature, and people abroad losing, you know, their confidence in the full faith and credit of the United States to pay its bills. That's what it's all predicated on, really. If I'm wrong, you can...
No. I mean, some harm was done with all these shenanigans, even though...
A lot of harm was done, I think.
Yeah, I think your statement is better than mine, Jim. But we didn't go over the so-called cliff. We stepped back from the cliff to the tune of, what, 3 months, 4 months?
Yeah.
And we get to have this fight all over again in February?
And they're going to do it again in February. They're going to try. They're going to redouble their efforts to achieve what they weren't able to achieve.
And they're busy rehabilitating themselves, like that guy out in Iowa who said we need more Ted Cruz's willing to be crucified for his beliefs. Which, you know, if I was serious about that, I would find that heretical. I would find that deeply offensive.
Well, it is to me too. And basically, what Ted Cruz is trying to do is to consolidate a power base, and you know, he's grandstanding and doing all kinds of things. But you know, I'm hoping until hope is abandoned that they don't try this crap again in the cold months of February, because you know that's going to be a bad thing.
There is so much snake oil and so much flim-flam in all of this. That statement by Gene Sperling yesterday still makes me about halfway nauseated that, you know, the Democrats are just going to have to eat some entitlement cuts. Bless their hearts, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren went absolutely into full sweat condition alpha over that and said, oh, hell no, it will not get through the Senate. Because, among other things, Social Security has absolutely nothing to do with the debt or the deficit.
No, but I think they have raided the Social Security Trust Fund, or at least they did when W was in the White House, right?
Even the so-called Social Security Trust Fund is a bit of a chimera, insofar as it's, you know, Social Security is what the Congress says it is. And the Congress thus far has said that Social Security is something that people get who reach the age of either 62 or 65, born within a certain generation, or then there's my generation, and I think we have to wait till, what, 67, 70, something like that?
I think it's 67 right now. They're trying to push it to 70.
Because they use that old argument that, you know, people are living longer.
Even though
we had the statistical evidence last week that talked about people in Mingo County, West Virginia, and you know Mingo County, Jim.
No, I really don't.
Well, okay. But, I mean, you know what a poverty nightmare it is.
Yeah.
I think maybe it was McDowell that was talking about.
There's some place called Jolo that really is the center of all that, isn't it?
But you know, if you happen to be born in that enclave of poverty and you know, just manifest sadness, you don't live to collect Social Security if you're a male. Your average lifespan is lower than the average lifespan of a peasant in Guatemala.
Yeah, you mentioned that the other night on your last week, I believe.
And yet at the same time, these people who dress in silk suits and have cars come for them in the morning and think that somehow they're living, you know, that they're living till they're 90, just because of, well, you know, the marvelous world in which we live, and say things like people are living to be older now. Well, no. No, because that's not true for people who work in the building trades, whether they're union or not. That's not true for people who do anything by the sweat of their brow. It's certainly not true for women in the South and in Appalachia.
But that's the
excuse that they use, because regardless of whether they talk about the debt or the deficit, at the end of the day, Jim, the very idea of Social Security is anathema to a Republican. And I'm not talking about to a Tea Party Republican. They have railed against Social Security as nascent communism from the moment that it was signed into law.
Yes, since 1935.
Right. And by the way, if you want to, this is a little bit off topic, but if you want to read something absolutely horrifying, just sickening, this being Halloween season, there is a new study out about the way a particularly pernicious, nasty, vile, filthy law firm headquartered in Charleston, West Virginia, and with offices all over Appalachia, Denver, Colorado, Washington, D.C., an outfit called Jackson Kelly. There's an article by the Center for Public Integrity on how they have lied and cheated and double dealt the federal black lung system to keep people who have been poisoned to death on the job in the coal mines from being able to receive you know, some pissant $700 a month in black lung benefits. And it's well worth the read. There's a link to it over at Ken Ward's blog, Coal Tattoo, at wvgazette.com/coaltattoo. And it's harrowing.
You know, I don't see how these people can actually live with themselves when they know what they're doing. They have no conscience.
Since James Clapper made a reference to Casablanca earlier today, I'll make one too. There's that scene when the Nazis are marching into Paris, and Sam looks at Rick and says, "Drinking all this champagne sure take the sting out of being occupied." Well, the fact of the matter is, if you're the senior partner for Black Lung Litigation Defense at Jackson and Kelly, you're making an amount of money that would choke a buzzard, and it takes a lot of the sting out of knowing that you've made your entire life out of screwing working people, widows and orphans, out of what they were justly due.
Well, you know, it's kind of like that movie Philadelphia that Tom Hanks played the AIDS victim, and that firm tried to disown him.
Right.
And just throw him completely under the bus. And Denzel Washington played his defense attorney. He didn't do him a whole lot of good for whatever time he had left. But nonetheless, that's the spirit and the drive that some of these people have who want to deprive other people benefits to which they are legally entitled. And that's a sad thing. It really is.
Yeah, and in fact, Ron and Raleigh just pointed out, Jim, that the whole business about people living longer, he said it's damn sure not true in the black community. The age of mortality for black men has been declining in this country since the rise of that greasy-headed old B-movie actor. And that's true.
Oh, I don't doubt that at all. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was no friend to anybody who... Well, I'll never forget what he said. Unless you're making $100,000 a year, this is 30 years ago, you're broke.
Yeah.
That was that told me exactly how much compassion he had for people who were disadvantaged and, you know, fell into the lower income brackets and things of that nature. And still they lionize him like he was just some type of god, and I just don't see it. I never have been able to see it. I mean, the guy really, over Iran-Contra, he should have been impeached.
Well, and remember who declared that he would not be.
Yeah.
Ben Bradley and Katherine Graham, who said the country couldn't stand another constitutional crisis on the heels of Watergate.
I was surprised to hear Kate Graham say that, and Ben Bradley say that, but I guess they had their tits in the ringer long enough where they couldn't fight it anymore.
No, what it was is they had access, and they were enjoying the Reagan ride.
Well, I guess so. I mean, you know, I think they had every presidential candidate over to the home for dinner. At least Kate Graham did, except Nixon. I don't think he was ever invited. So they were power brokers in Washington, but, you know, if they could have taken Reagan to task for Iran-Contra, things would be a lot different, and his presidency would not have ended very well.
But, you know, it always offended me because there's nothing in the Constitution that says impeachment shall not be used unless the country is up for it, Jim.
Well, I guess so.
Do you understand what I mean?
I
mean, there's nothing that says thou shalt use impeachment only once every 75 years.
Right. Well, I think impeachment is due whenever it's necessary, whether the country's up for it or not, when somebody is, you know, in contravention of the law. Of course, Reagan certainly came on the air one night and he just said he just didn't know. When I saw that speech, I thought to myself, well, if you didn't know, who in the hell did know if you didn't? And, of course, with Oliver North and Poindexter and all those fellow travelers of his, And yet, look how they turned out. Ollie North has a program, I think he still does, if he hadn't jumped into the Potomac, or, and then Gordon Liddy.
He got himself a radio show.
Yeah, he's got a radio show, and, you know, Ollie North, I mean, you know, I guess he looked good in his uniform and stuff like that, but, you know, on the Alexander police blotter back in, I don't know when he was a young man, and he was caught by the police running naked through the streets of Alexandria.
I thought that was in the middle of Iran-Contra or something.
Well, I'm not sure. It, you know, it sort of fades back in the memory because there was so much crap going on there. Who, you know, I can't sort it out. But I remember the story came out on him that, you know, he was caught running naked. And, you know, why? And, you know, I don't think Streaky was in vogue at that particular time. But nonetheless, he was by himself and the police hauled him in.
Well, that whole thing was so sordid, the business with the lockbox full of money in his closet, and of course he's embraced by the right wing fundamentalists, and I mean it, just in terms of hypocrisy, I've got a pair of competing quotes here from that life support system for a haircut, Sean Hannity.
He is a piece of work, isn't he?
Oh, say okay. So consider. You remember when we first learned about domestic spying back when Dim Leader declared that the Constitution was, and I quote, just a goddamn piece of paper, unquote?
I do.
Okay, so back then, when the New York Times buried that story lest it harm George W. Bush in his 2004 electoral efforts, Sean Hannity declared, "Our techniques are working. We've got the NSA program here. We've got the Patriot Act program here. You know, it's staggering to me that we are even debating the use of these techniques in this country even at this time." Well, now fast forward, Jim, to the Obama administration, and we all, of course, know that Barack Obama invented domestic spying.
Oh, sure, I know he did.
So Hannity then declares, "Big Brother is monitoring your every move, whether it be online or on the telephone. These actions by the Obama administration are clear, very clear violations of the Fourth Amendment." That tells me everything I need to know.
Yeah, it does me too. I have to agree with you there.
You know, spying is good when it's done by the white guy.
Yeah. I tell you, we've come an awful long way, or gone an awful long way into the inner depths, or whatever, in the past 15 years. That's for damn sure.
Well, I tell you what, if you want to see something fascinating, I was provided something last night that absolutely blew my mind, and you may already know about this, but it took me by surprise. It is an op-ed written in December 1963 on the heels of the assassination of John Kennedy.
By the way, they've got a new book out about that. It was on Book TV about this guy.
By Harry Truman.
Okay.
And Harry had apparently become dismayed at the overreach of the Central Intelligence Agency. And it's a very brief thing. December 22nd, 1963, published on page A11 of the Washington Post. And he closed saying, "We have grown up as a nation, respected for our free institutions and for our ability to maintain a free and open society. There is something about the way the CIA has been functioning that is casting a shadow over our historic position, and I feel we need to correct it."
I remember that. I do. And, you know, going back to the CIA's, let me put it this way, the assassination of President Kennedy and how the Warren Commission was put together. I mean, Earl Warren did not want to chair that commission. And LBJ said, "You will do it." Actually dragged him out of the Supreme Court building, made him come to the Oval Office, and got this over him, and he said, you will do it. And as far as the members of the Warren Commission are concerned, there was a lot of antipathy between the people who sat on it. And according to this guy's book, Sheehan, I think he's not, that's his name, but someone can correct me, it was on Book TV this weekend, that very seldom, if ever, was there a full meeting of the entire Warren Commission because there was so much antipathy between the members of it. It's just a wonder that the thing got produced. And this guy went into all the mechanics of the Warren Commission and stuff like that, but he said there is just no way that these people could have really produced what they said they produced, because at the most, only two or three were in attendance at the meetings. And of course, the autopsy photos were never given to the Warren Commission. I think Earl Warren may have seen them, and then they were taken over by Robert Kennedy. But none of the other members of the Warren Commission ever saw those autopsy photos.
Amazing.
I mean, it was just something else.
Maybe someday Jim will know.
Well, I doubt it. I don't know. There's some things you can bury in government so deeply that, you know, they just basically wait for people to die off and, you know, they just forget about it.
Yeah. Well, Jim, it's been a good conversation.
Well, by the way, Michael Myers is on TV, and I found a good way to stop Michael Myers.
Yeah?
I just started to send these people an email at AMC who's putting this on. I said, give him one of my urine samples. That'll take care of him.
Jim.
I don't need to be vulgar, but I was just thinking, because they're always throwing all this stuff in his face and he always gets back up.
Yeah, everything.
I mean, but I say, give him one of my urine samples. That'll kill him. He'll be gone forever.
Jim, have a good night.
Night, Bert.
Bye. Jim calling in, and we are still at $145 for tonight's fundraising, which means that if we don't catch up, that means tomorrow night's fundraising goal will be $295. But thanks for the help thus far. Thanks to Sal, and thanks to Tony, and thanks to Jude, and thanks to our buddy Robert in Australia. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm well. Dave?
Yeah, this is Dave. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
You're well. I was just enjoying your conversations with the previous couple of gentlemen. I listened to Bill and enjoying his talk about Midway and all that stuff and all of the court packing. Hey, I thought that we settled all that crap a while ago on the court packing.
We did when it was really court packing. This isn't court packing. This is just the president trying to do the president thing.
No. I thought that Harry Reid was about to pull the nuclear option about a couple of months ago or something like that, and they were going to, and then they backed down.
Well, no. Now he says he might have to do it again, or might have to do it actually.
Good. I hope he does. I hope he grows a set for a change. But I don't know why people don't think we have a lot of money. There is tons of money in this country. We just got to go get it. It's not in this country. It's out in the Caymans, but it's there.
Yeah.
We just got to go get it. You there?
I'm here.
Yeah. I mean, people don't seem to realize that.
Well, my buddy Tom out in the San Francisco Bay Area, who kindly helped me knock a chunk off my bucket list by taking me sailing out there when I was out there at the beginning of 2013, sent me some pictures from the America's Cup of some of the yachts that showed up. And one of them was a yacht that is owned by a San Francisco Bay Area hedge fund manager, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
Care to guess the flag it was flying? You just said it a minute ago.
Oh, Caymans, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cayman Islands.
Because, you know, we can't have our hedge fund managers actually paying any property taxes on multi-million dollar yachts in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Not Teddy Pritzker's family or Feinstein's husband or any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's confiscatory, that taxation. I guess they just want to be Americans for free. Is that it, Dave?
I think, I don't know what they want to be. I know what I want them to be. But I don't know what they want to be. I don't give a crap, really. But, yeah, speaking of the Bay Area, you know, the wires were really hot down here in Portland this morning on KBOO, our public radio station, about Santa Rosa. You know, some child was executed over there with a toy gun. You talked about it a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
People are really pissed about that stuff down there. Down in Santa Rosa, they're really really pissed. They're really really hot about it. It's kind of giving me I'm getting sensations like Rodney King or something like that. Like something happened. I don't know.
Well, there's a great degree of unease all over this country, and of course, understand, please, Dave, that it is an unease that the teabaggers are happy to have. We're not talking about a malaise. We're talking about a profound sense of tension. You know, Ted Cruz today, I don't know if you noticed, but he lectured the mother of Trayvon Martin about how stand your ground laws in Florida are good for the niggers.
Uh-huh. Sure. But, well, you know, I guess they're just trying to provoke something.
Well, you know, 53% of African Americans who stand their ground have successfully done so, and only 51% of good white people who stood their ground in Florida have gotten away with it.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Those are interesting percentages.
This man's a Christian. This man has been anointed to be president of the United States by his very own daddy and prayed over by a bunch of fundies in Iowa, and has the nerve to look at Trayvon Martin's mama and say, stand your ground was good for your dead son.
There's no way that he can be president anyway. What is it, the 14th Amendment? Or what is the amendment that says so? There's an amendment that says so in the Bill of Rights, or in the Constitution.
Well, I mean, he's only three-fifths of a human being. Well, I think you have to be a human being to be president.
So, Ted Cruz?
Oh, no. I thought you were talking about Barack Obama. No, Ted Cruz can be president because Jesus wants him to.
But he wasn't born here. I'll vote for Arnold Schwarzenegger before I vote for him. Schwarzenegger's been trying to get the Constitution changed for like 20 years, hasn't he?
Right.
Under the same thing. The guy wasn't born here, so there's no way he can be president.
But it's interesting. In the case of Cruz, they say no. His mama and his daddy were Americans, so he could have been born on the moon and he can still be president.
American soil. He wasn't born here on American soil. He wasn't born in the United States.
And people and now the right wing is saying, well, that don't matter. I mean, Jesus, where Schwarzenegger's concerned, his father was a Nazi.
Yeah.
But that's not a bar to the presidency, because the leading conservative on the Supreme Court is the son of the American president of the Mussolini Admiration Society.
Right. Don't you want an Austrian for president? It worked really well for the Germans, I think.
Oh, Jesus. You know, I think we've got a yearning. Cruz's father was a Cuban emigre. His mama was an American. And you know, that doesn't matter, because his skin is lighter than the color of a brown paper bag.
No. Where was he born?
Doesn't matter.
I think that's not what that amendment to the Constitution.
The 14th Amendment?
Yes, I think.
No, they're saying
American soil, or maybe it's before that. Maybe it's in the first.
I'm being somewhat obtuse here. The right wing has a "do as I say, not as I do" standard. They've got a double standard. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know that. I know that.
His mama was American, just like that Kenyan's mama. He got to be president. But what they don't understand is that Hawaii was a state.
Yeah.
Lost on.
Yeah, well, you
totally
know.
Freaking lost on. Well, Canada, you know, is not a state.
Well, you know what they say. You know, you let Al Qaeda into Libya, and soon they'll be in Africa. But all kidding aside, that's what it says in the Constitution. At some point, you have to read the book. I guess it's not that hard of a read either. You know, but
no, it's really more of a pamphlet than a book.
Yeah. I have one in my bathroom, and I go halfway through it between each, you know, visit. But it's just absurd.
So, hey, I gotta get out of here. I'm getting time checks from Randy in PA. He tells me I'm 2 minutes away from time to leave.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, Dave.
Bye.
Bye now. Dave calling from Oregon. And thanks to everybody for all your participation. Thanks for helping us take care of last night's deficit. Maybe we'll take care of tonight's deficit tomorrow. If you want to help out, head on radionetwork.com. That's where the PayPal button is. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Our all-volunteer staff, thank you to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. That is where you go. That is how you can help us end Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rich Smith is next on the Horn.